This is On the Other Hand. A podcast sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas, this podcast explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through having conversations with community leaders. Today, we're going to be talking to another leader in Arkansas who works with others in the community who may have differing views from his own.
Hello, and welcome to On the Other Hand. I'm your host, Glenn White, here with my co-host, April Chatham Carpenter. Get ready for today's conversation as we learn how community leaders in Arkansas are helping work towards solutions. April, who are we chatting with today?
Glenn, we have a very special guest today. I'm so excited about getting to have him on our show. This gentleman, his family has lived in Arkansas for generations. He was actually trained at MIT in nuclear engineering, received his PhD in urban planning. He's got a long list of things that he has done: physicist, minister, educator, nonprofit, executive leader, and last but not least, father to three daughters. Plus, he's married to an emergency medicine physician who is also a U.S. Air Force combat veteran, Dr. Geraldine Jones. That's your cue, folks, if you don't know who this is yet, that we are welcoming recent candidate for governor of Arkansas, Dr. Chris Jones, to our podcast.
And I could not be more happy than to have Chris on here. Chris, welcome. So this podcast, On the Other Hand, is something I think you've heard a little bit about. We talked to community leaders who in some way have tried to reach across various types of division. Politics is one big one. It doesn't have to be politics. It can be any number of things. In fact, I have in mind a question or two for you in other areas that may come up at some point. Anyway, let's start here today by having you just give us a few high points of who you are. Now, I know you ran for governor, so you put out your bio quite a bit, and it's an impressive one, as April points out. But tell us just a few things about yourself, including some things we may not have heard recently.
Yeah, sure. Well, again, thanks for having me on. I'm really excited for the conversation. Look, I'm just a kid from Pine Bluff, Arkansas. I had a fairly common, normal childhood growing up, playing a lot in the woods. I'm a Gen Xer. So we were kind of latchkey kids, grew up on Schoolhouse Rock and all that stuff. So I think that had a big influence on how I saw the world. And at the same time, my parents allowed me to explore a number of different things growing up. Now, I did grow up in a zip code that one would say was destined for below average in Pine Bluff. You know, not a lot of folks make it out, or there's a narrative that not a lot of folks make it out and do special things. But the reality is there are a number of people that make it out and do amazing things. I will add that a couple of things that I didn't really talk about a lot on the campaign trail, but they're a part of who I am. You know, I loved playing sports growing up, and I actually tore my knee and had knee surgery when I was in the 11th grade. Now, here's what's interesting about that. Before that, for some reason, I thought I was going to grow up to be a professional sports player. And then I tore my knee, and I was like, you know what? I might as well throw myself even more into my academics. And my coach came back and told me one day, he said, you know, I'm really glad that happened, because you really didn't have a career in sports anyway, so you should have stuck with academics. But, you know, I always tried to do good by people, to live a life with no regrets, and to enjoy and have fun at every moment. And the minute I start to stray from those things, I've tried to reset. So I'm blessed, and I'm here.
And we appreciate you being here. Great story. I'm glad. I'm not happy about your having the knee injury, but I'm glad you went in the direction you did. That's obviously where your greatest talents lie. And I have no idea about the athletic endeavor part. Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't the best. So that was okay, I was decent.
Okay. All right. So let me ask you this now. So obviously you have politics as a big part of the draw for getting you on here. So you may know, we talk in Braver Angels about red versus blue, and that's a common way of distinguishing kind of the liberal versus conservative, Democrat versus Republican. We recognize there are a lot of different colors and political views that people have. So it may be red if you're on the conservative side, blue on the liberal or progressive side, purple if you're in between, there's green. Who knows? What I want to ask you, because we ask all our guests this, even though it may seem obvious, where would you put yourself on that color spectrum politically?
Yeah, the color spectrum is such a phenomenal thing. And I am a Democrat. And I'm also a physicist. And so I think about optics and colors and the like. And if I apply my physics brain, I would say my color spectrum is black. Because black is the presence of all colors.
Yeah.
And for me, there are solutions on the red side that can be applied to specific problems, and there are solutions on the blue side that can be applied to specific problems. So I think it's better to say, what is the problem we're trying to solve, and where is the best solution coming from? So I'd say I'm black. No pun intended.
That's a brilliant answer. I love hearing that. And as a physicist, yeah, I guess you would know that sort of thing. So that's a new way of looking at things, isn't it, April?
Absolutely.
Okay. So given that you're black politically and all that encompasses, tell us a little bit about some of the values that you've held or hold now or been raised with, what life experiences, upbringing, whatever influences developed your current political views.
Yeah, so I grew up in a household that deeply believed in being explicit about values. So my mom is, I would say she, her life is an improbable journey. My dad's life is an improbable journey, meaning my mom was supposed to be one of 11 children, but she's an only child. Because every other child was miscarriage, stillbirth, or passed not long after they were born. So for her, family mattered a lot because she was this only child and supposed to have a lot of siblings. And so she created a family environment. It was the church, it was our neighbors, it was our cousins. And for my dad, this idea of taking whatever you have and using it with excellence to make the world better came from a couple of places. One, his grandfather owned a lot of land in Mississippi. And one night, as the story goes, one of his grandfather's friends came and said, "Hey, the Klan has found out that you have oil under your land." And so that night they had to pack up, cross the river, and come to Arkansas. And that's how my dad's family ended up in East Arkansas in Hughes. And he grew up poor, and he grew up picking cotton. And he said, "I never want to be in that place." And so he worked hard, he went to college, and he instilled in us the importance of working hard and the importance of believing that even though my current conditions look a certain way, they don't have to stay that way. And I play a role in creating a new future. So those were super influential on me as a kid who grew up in the zip code, who my trajectory was not supposed to lead to getting 2 degrees from Morehouse College and 3 degrees from MIT and being married to a phenomenal wife. And now, even on this Valentine's Day, I still have to ask myself, why did she say yes? Because I outkicked my coverage. I way outkicked my coverage. But I look at that and I say, I'm blessed. And that's the other value that I hold, like looking at situations, circumstances, and where I am and realizing the blessing in that. So I'd say family, hard work, and appreciating the blessing of what's been given to me.
Gosh, appreciate that.
I love hearing those stories because it reminds me of how we end up, we bring in so much into our present from the past, whether we even recognize necessarily what that past is. And so thank you for sharing that. You know, you talked about when you were identifying your color, that you believe that there are solutions on all sides that we can apply and to look at the problem and determine what the best solution is. And I'm sure that over the years, as you've worked with people in the community, in different communities, that you've had plenty of chances to work with people who differ from you in some way. And so I'd like to hear a little bit about your approach to how you go about working with those who differ from you in some respect, and maybe you can provide us a couple of examples of that so people can hear your style and what you do in terms of communicating across differences.
Yeah. So let me give a little bit more context on that before I answer. And that is that when I think about how I came to believe that solutions can come from anywhere, part of it is that that's what my parents instilled in us. And they pushed us to explore and pushed us to even justify the thing that we were saying at all times. But it also came from my academic experience. I am a physicist, I'm a mathematician, I'm an urban planner, I'm a sociologist, I'm a minister. And what I learned in doing all those things, as opposed to only doing one thing, is that there are different ways to see the world and view the world. Right? And real quick, I say, you know, there's a story about the elephant. Different people are touching different parts of the elephant, and they all describe it, and they describe it in a million different ways, and they're all correct. Now, that's not always the case in life. So when it comes to how do I work with people, some of it comes down to understanding and appreciating the fact that everybody is different. Now, we're more the same, but everybody brings some difference to the table. And I think that difference is valuable when brought to the table. So I look for that difference and I try to pull it out in others to say, hey, look, I think I have my strengths. There are areas where you're stronger than me. So let's find that and bring it in. That helps, particularly in spaces where it could potentially be conflictual. Where I draw a line is when our values don't align. You know, you don't get to come into my space and degrade me and denigrate me or treat others poorly. So in those instances, I don't try to work with folks because that is fundamentally against what we're doing. Outside of that, and I remember when I worked at the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative in Boston. It's a community-based organization that was resident-developed. And what they did there was they really transformed the neighborhood. But I was coming as an engineer working with them and ended up taking over as executive director. I was working with longtime activists. And our approach and our view to the world was fundamentally different. But what I had to do was spend more time listening and learning. And then once I did that, it set the stage for them to hear me. And that's how I approach difference.
Thank you for drawing the distinction between just the value of differences and also, you know, knowing when it is that maybe it is more difficult, like when those values don't align, to actually work across that. What kinds of strategies do you use? You mentioned listening to help you that effectively communicate and work with others who are different than you.
Well, I'll, in full transparency, there are certainly times when I don't effectively communicate. And you can just ask my wife and daughters and they'll tell you that there are plenty of times when I don't effectively communicate. But having said that, you know, when I've done the best is when I've created space between and John Maxwell and Stephen Covey talk about this a lot, like creating space between stimulus and response. And the stimulus being what I hear from them and what I see from them and my response to what I hear and what I see. The more I'm able to create space, and in that space, I listen, I try to find understanding, I try to get to the fact territory. And in doing so, once I gain that better understanding, then my response is often way better. When I immediately respond and I don't try to understand, that's when I found that my communication is poor, my communication is lacking, and the tensions grow. And I equate, there's an interesting book by Amanda Ripley that talks about high conflict. And she talks about these conflict entrepreneurs. And I believe that the conflict entrepreneurs are the ones who try to eliminate the space between stimulus and response. They want you to have a stimulus and immediately respond. And I think the way we counter the conflict entrepreneurs and create what she calls high conflict, the tension that is good, that leads to a better place, is when we create more space between stimulus and response.
I love that book. I use it actually in one of my classes on listening and civil dialogue. Yeah, as one of the texts and the examples that she provides certainly illustrate that. And then the mindfulness. I mean, that's what we're slowing things down. I just had a recent conversation with a colleague in Braver Angels actually, in which we were talking about how do we do that when our emotions are engaged at such a level. And I think we don't do it perfectly. What do you do when your emotions, when maybe you're hearing somebody that the values aren't aligning, or it appears that they aren't? How do you slow yourself down?
Yeah. I find that I'm best at slowing myself down when I prepared before I need to. Right? So when I walk out the door, now as I put my ministerial hat on, I would say that when I put on the full armor of God, right? So and those of the Christian faith will understand what I'm saying. But what that means is that when I prepare my mind and my spirit for whatever I'm going to engage, that when I've done that, then I'm better able to, it's less about changing the inputs and more about processing before I give an output. Right? So yeah, inputs are coming in, stimulus is coming in, nonstop. And what I have to do is, and the way you do it, the way I've done it that works is in part to try to tease out what's important and what's extraneous. And that there's a risk there, because some things you might say as extraneous are actually important, but appreciating that risk too. And then once you tease that out, giving yourself the time to then think about that important stuff. There's a anecdotal saying that I've heard, and I don't recall who said it, but effectively they said they don't make a decision until the last possible minute, because there's no need to make it before. Right? So you give yourself time and space, and some will call that procrastinating. Others will call it giving yourself time and space to gather all the necessary inputs and the process appropriately, and then you make the decision, and once it's made, then you move on.
That's good. Glenn?
Okay, I'm wondering about this. It's obvious to all of us. These days, there's an incredible amount of negativity, hostility, and conflict in the world and in our country, more than I can remember since maybe the 60s, probably. And one of the things that I've done in as a psychologist is because I've been curious about that. So I started looking at the social sciences literature to figure out what accounts for all this polarization? What are the factors that make it worse? How do you deal with it? So I learned a lot of things about that, and I talked about that on a few previous podcasts. But I wonder, everybody's experience is different. Now, from your perspective and your experience when you work with people across the political aisle, what do you think are the things that produce such friction between individuals and groups politically?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question, and it's so layered. And I'm an armchair psychologist, so real very bootleg. Yeah, exactly. But as I think about it, right, and I think about and as I do apply my sociology training, and then I think, apply my engineering mind, what I perceive is that there's the lived experience, the thing that we actually encounter, and then there's how we tell the lived experience, the narrative we hear. And it seems that the telling of the lived experience is more and more disassociated from the actual lived experience. So what you'll hear is in a place like Harrison, Arkansas, which has a history of being a historically racist place, the Klan was there. But what you'll hear in the narrative is that a black man shouldn't go there, a black Democrat shouldn't campaign there. But the lived experience, because I campaigned there and I went there on multiple occasions, the lived experience is that you got folks there who are who are veterans who struggle with suicide. You got folks there who are parents who are trying to figure out how to get the best education for their kid. You got folks there who are neighbors who are just trying to look out for their neighbors. that's the lived experience. And far too often, the sort of the volume of this created narrative is turned up so high that we can't break through to the actual lived experience. And I think that is killing us.
So it sounds like there's a stereotype that develops based on a kernel of truth in some cases, but it goes way beyond what the reality is. And there's so many other facets to the reality that if you can get in there and live it and talk to people, you find that out.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I would say that that's why conversations like these are so important, because you get to unpack the narrative and see it, does it align with the lived experience? Can we have a collective narrative that collectively tells us it's actually a full elephant, you know, not just a hard tusk, right? And I think our media outlets, social and traditional, have gotten to the point to where they are less concerned about the actual lived experience and more concerned about creating a narrative that benefits them personally.
Absolutely. That's true. So with that, when you talk about the one-to-one individual interactions that you have with people, that gets into something I think that underlies a lot of what we do, which is the importance of relationships in developing a more nuanced understanding of people and what they're about and what they believe. And as you said before, it's just not nearly as simple as the sometimes stereotypical stories we tell ourselves about a situation. So given all this incivility, hostility, conflict we have now in our country over politics, you, like all of us, encounter times when the conversation with someone else who has differences starts to take a negative turn. And I wonder if you could tell us more about how you respond. Now, you did say earlier that at some point you just kind of, you don't deal with people like that. You move on and deal elsewhere. But how do you do it, at least in the moment, how do you deal with situations like that and people where there's such, you know, hostile and you know, just in built-in differences that they can't change?
Yeah, another loaded question. and I say that because I don't assume that our differences are insurmountable barriers. All right, so I come in assuming that our differences are not barriers, they're actually activators. And if we could use our difference as the activators they are, we can create a much better world. There's a book by Anand, I cannot pronounce his last name, but it's called The Persuaders. And in it, he talks about how this sort of relational dynamics can overcome some of those quote unquote difference barriers, if you would. You know, for me, I recall a time when I was in Northeast Arkansas and had a conversation in what should have been a hostile engagement, right? So, a woman spoke with her. She came back later. She whispered in my ear and said, because she left and it was great. She came back and whispered and said, "Are you a Democrat?" And I leaned in. I whispered back. I said, "Yes." And she said, "Ah." She said, "But I'm still going to support you." But here's what was interesting. She said, "My daughter-in-law wouldn't even speak to you because you're a Democrat." So my response was, "Well, is she here?" And she said, "Yeah." I was like, "Well, let's go talk to her." Because I wanted to understand what is motivating her. What is the world that she wants to see? Because it could be that we want to see the same world. We just think there's a different way to get there. And it turns out my first encounter with her, the first few minutes, the tension was there. And her body language said, "Get away from me." By the time we finished, we were laughing and joking and hugging. Now, did we fundamentally change our ideology? No. But did we create a small open door to say that I can have a different ideology and still be human and be a part of the larger humanity that Dr. King talked about, that we are, you know, caught in a network, an inescapable network of mutuality?
That's good, because it kind of gets at that problem we have now with dehumanizing people on the other side. That happens so often, and that just drives us further and further apart from any kind of ability to compromise and reach solutions and problem solve. So I appreciate that.
Hey, Glenn, if I could jump one other thing on that, because you know, your point strikes a huge chord, and that is that if there is a handful of things that we can do among that handful to make the world better, among that handful of things, I believe is to rehumanize each other. Like you think about the reason the slave trade was able to go on for so long was because people were convinced that folks that were darker skinned and looked different from them were actually not humans, they were animals. The reason that we're able to, you know, imprison so many people and not care is because we don't see them as human. The mentally disabled folks, we don't see them as human. Homeless people, we don't see them as human. Folks who are struggling with addiction. But when the minute we rehumanize people and say, actually, they're my neighbor. And if they're my neighbor, I'm forced to care about them because I care about my neighbors. I think we need to rehumanize each other.
Totally agree. And I think that's part of what we try to do. And when we follow the philosophy and that Braver Angels talks about, which is basically mirroring the kind of things you talk about and that we hear all the time on this program when we talk to people who are effectively reaching across the aisle, then that makes a big difference. So I guess the other thing I was going to ask was just basically how you deal with people who are just intransigent and not willing to compromise. You just basically aren't willing to see that point. I gather that there's hope for redemption for everybody. But if you get anyone who's really difficult, do you have any other thoughts about how to deal with those folks?
Yeah, I mean, look, you can think what you want to think. You can, you know, in this country, you can say what you want to say, and I think that's fine. You can't act how you want to act. There is a line, right? You can't act in a way that is harmful to others. And if folks are being intransigent, they need to be called out. Right? It doesn't mean that they're irredeemable. It does mean that their actions are saying that they need to be, that we need to be protected from that negative action. Now, there's a whole point about calling in folks, and I think you should do that. Like calling them to a higher calling, that's where you start. You spend as much time as possible there. And yet, if people consistently and persistently do things, you have to stop them. You don't call in Hitler. You don't say, you know, Hitler, let's continue to sit down and have these loving conversations and whatnot. You stop the evil where it is. And you say, this is unacceptable. You cannot treat people like this. And we will not allow it in what I call, and this is not mine, but from, again, sociological training, there's a social contract that we have with each other. And the social contract makes up the social construct that we live in. And in this country, that contract should be that all are created equal. And if all are created equal, then you don't get to treat me like I'm subhuman. And the minute you start treating me like a subhuman, you're breaking the social contract. And there should be consequences for breaking the social contract.
And the thing about social contracts is it's largely voluntary. People don't appreciate that. We think about how much we have in the way of laws and the Constitution that dictate things. It still requires individuals and most of society to agree to that and to, in good faith, abide by that social contract. And the minute a number of people in a large group begins to go against that social contract, society and democratic institutions can break down. So that's a great point.
Unless you need to go against it, right? So what King did was he went against the social contract of the time in order to create a better society. Because the social contract was en masse oppressing a group of people. And what he said was, this contract isn't working. And if you look at his Poor People's March, it isn't working for poor whites. It isn't working for blacks. It isn't working for Hispanics. Isn't working for women. And we have to change the social contract in order to make it work for us to live up to our ideals. In that sense, yes, we push against that the way it currently exists until we are able to get to our ideals. And that changes the norm. Yep.
Well, that helps clarify things for me. I appreciate that distinction.
I like the distinction also between calling in and versus calling out. Although you didn't use the word calling out, but one of the things that's so difficult is I think, and I'm going to move into questions here related to your work towards wanting to be governor in your campaign. But I think it's so difficult unless we do the kind of work that you're talking about, that you talked about, that you did in Harrison, that you did with this woman and her daughter. If we don't have a conversation with them and start learning about their stories and their life experiences, then we may always think we have to call out someone because we're making assumptions about what we believe that they think and what their values are, which may very well not be true. And that's what I've been hearing, some of the things that you've been talking about. One of the things that impressed me about, even as a read about your campaign for governor, was that you tended to try to run a positive and respectful race. Your campaign, and we've started seeing that across the United States in terms of other people as well that are trying to run positive campaigns. It's hard though if your base wants you to run a negative campaign, how you actually stand up and do that. And so I'd love for you to talk a little bit about how you dealt with those tensions with your base as you were trying to, if there were any, as you were trying to also run a respectful race.
Yeah, you know, I would say there are actors within and around the quote-unquote base that try to encourage you to do things that feed this vicious cycle that we are in. One, and two, I would say that the structures that exist they incentivize negativity. It incentivizes that vicious cycle, and that's across the spectrum, right? The incentive is to say something horrible about the character of the other person, and then that draws in a ton of money. And you justify it by saying, I need the money to put boots on the ground to engage people, right? So the system itself had a perverse incentive. And that was one thing that I was constantly fighting against, the perverse incentive. And look, if I can be fully transparent, you know, I think that my opponent in many ways fed into that vicious cycle. Now she never said anything against me, but it was enough against and enough negativity that drew in and sucked in the kind of resources that one sees when you get in that cycle. So how do I deal with it? You know, I go back to saying that before you walk out the door, you kind of have the full armor on. For me, for the campaign, before we launched, I listed out a set of values that personally I tied them all to scripture. But they in many ways transcend scripture. You don't have to be a Christian to appreciate the values. And it was always about, are we aligned with the value? So forget what the incentive is. Forget what the fact actors are saying. Is it or is it not aligned with the value? And if it's aligned with the value, and it happens to also be something that brings in the resources, that's great. Let's do it. If it's aligned with the value, if it's misaligned with the values and brings in resources, then I can't do it. So that was a way to sort of keep to say, look, I need it, and here's some of the things tangibly that I did. I didn't ever want my daughters to look at anything I did and be embarrassed or be ashamed. I never want my mom and dad to look at anything I did and say, that's not who we raised. And I didn't ever want to walk into a grocery store and folks look at me and say, oh my gosh, like you're not the one. Now, you can do that though and still shine a light on what is wrong. You can shine a light on things that actually are making life horrible for people and destroying the social fabric and the social contract that we say we want.
Thanks, Chris, for being our guest today for this first session. And my goodness, we have talked about so many things, from the importance to build space between a stimulus and response and understand first and listen and find the lived experiences of others to try to find our commonalities. So we're really looking forward to having another session with you. We've run out of time for now, but we have so many more things to talk about, so we look forward to continuing the conversation.
When you visit our website, you can help us improve our program by responding to a brief survey, for which you'll find a link on our webpage. You can also email us for program or speaker ideas or other feedback. Just send that email to otherhandar@gmail.com. That's otherhandar@gmail.com.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, Glenn White,
and April Chatham Carpenter.
Have a good evening, and let's all work to bring our community closer together.